It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 109 for Friday, the 1st of February, 2013. This week, BlackBerry unveils the phone and phone software it hopes will put it back in the race with Apple, Google, and Microsoft, and we get a first look. Plus, a perfume expert has bottled history and landmarks for your nasal nostalgia, and a new iOS game called Boyfriend Trainer lets you beat, strangle, and electrocute your virtual partner into submission. Harmless tongue-in-cheek humour or a worrying sign that the topic of domestic violence has been demoted below the concerns of nudity and gore. We'll discuss that and more as we train this week's boyfriend of Wired News. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langston here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, of course, is Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And Liat Clark.
Hello all.
I don't think we've podcasted together since December, actually, because I was away for ages.
It was when you just came back from Japan.
Was it really?
I think so, yeah.
That is really? That's a long time ago. Interesting. Well, for more interesting facts, keep listening. But it's good. We've got a lot to get through today. But the first thing I wanted to talk about was something that has been all over the news. A lot of people will have been hard-pressed to ignore this if you've even turned a TV on, I'm sure. RIM, the company that makes BlackBerry phones, has made several big announcements this week. First, it's dropped the RIM from its name, so the company is now just BlackBerry. That's exciting, isn't it? I'm fairly excited about that.
I think it is, actually, because I think it's that caused quite a lot of confusion in the market.
Yeah. It also launched the BlackBerry 10 mobile operating system, which it's betting its entire future on, up against iOS, Android, and Windows Phone. The company's also announced two flagship phones that will run the new BB10 operating system. Now, I went along to the launch event this week to use these phones, and I've got one of them in the office. The first is an all-touchscreen phone called the Z10, which kind of looks like a lot of the other glass-fronted black slabs on the market. No keyboard, all that sort of thing. And then there's the Q10, which looks a bit more like a traditional BlackBerry. It's got a full physical QWERTY keyboard, which is kind of one of, you know, BlackBerry's biggest selling points has been the keyboards.
What did you think of them?
Well, I was going to get to that in a little bit, but we can talk about it now. Well, I mean, the Z10 is really interesting. What BlackBerry's basically had to do is take everything that it's been doing for the last few years and get rid of it for the most part, because people have been moving towards iPhones and Android phones, and, you know, a couple of percent of people have been going towards Windows phones. And BlackBerry had to say, people don't want this kind of, you know, very clunky, business-focused, kind of cluttered OS with no apps, but a keyboard. They want the sort of stuff that the iPhone guys and the Android guys have got, which is rich apps and touchscreens and simple interface and all this sort of stuff. And that's kind of what they've built. And I actually think they've got off to a really good start. And it's the company really is betting everything on BB10 and these new phones, because it's been hot water for a long time now. It's pretty much failed to compete effectively with the likes of Apple and Google, at least in terms of keeping people on its platform out of choice rather than, say, workplace necessity, because a lot of companies just give BlackBerries out.
And I guess the issue is there's now this massive trend towards bring your own device, which, hate the BYOD like acronym, or not acronym, initialism, but it's true. People are expecting the sort of, you know, functionality you get on your home device in at work as well.
That's right. And that's one of the things that's actually quite interesting about BB10 is that it has this alternating profile picker sort of thing. So, for example, you could say, Liv, you had one of these devices. There may be a bunch of apps, settings, you know, home screen icons and stuff that you want just for while you're at work.
Yeah.
You know, just work-focused things. But then when you get home, you might just want games, social networking, and, you know, unicorn photos or whatever.
Yeah.
And so the phone actually allows you to toggle between two completely different modes. So you can basically be in business mode, or you can be in personal mode, and they look and feel completely different. You don't have to, of course, but you can if you want. Different email accounts, different Twitter accounts, all that sort of stuff, which I think is a really neat idea.
That is really neat.
That was a problem that was really highlighted with the Alicia Keys story, that she admitted she used her BlackBerry for work. And
hang on, we haven't actually mentioned that Alicia Keys is obviously the brand ambassador, or the creative director. She's been announced.
BlackBerry, it seems to be the in thing at the moment, that, you know, companies needing you know, some extra promotion just hire a celebrity for some weird and vacuous role.
No, but they gave her quite an amazing job title, isn't it? Creative director, which course she
hasn't
actually...
Isn't that what they gave them all?
Well, there was Lady Gaga was on for Polaroid, and there was...
Will.i.am, Intel. But I suspect he's a bit more hands-on
Well, I am, maybe. We're drifting slightly off topic. The other thing I wanted to mention about the BlackBerry thing is they've integrated video calling into BBM. So BBM, obviously, very, very popular alternative to texting.
Yeah.
And the new video calling function actually lets you share your screen of your phone with another BlackBerry user. So if you, say, Liv, were abroad and wanted to desperately show me some, I don't know, slide from a presentation you're working on,
God forbid.
Have I ever asked you to send me a slide?
No.
No. All right, let's say a photograph that's on your screen, or maybe...
Why do you not just send it?
Well, think about this. You're on a video call. We're chatting, and you say, oh, I'd love to show you this photo of what I just saw down the road. You just fire it up, and you can share your screen. So your screen appears on their screen remotely, which... All right, maybe you aren't the target.
I'm just trying to think in what circumstances
cool,
that would be useful.
You would usually say, have you seen the picture I posted of that account on Facebook? Go check it out.
For tablets, that makes a bit more sense for kind of, as you say, like video conferencing presentations. But for a mobile phone, I mean, I'm not really sure what...
Yeah, it's kind of awkward...
Yeah, have a look at my inbox.
Conversation.
Well, I'm sure people listening can probably think of a time they've been on a video call or FaceTime or Skype with someone on a phone and, you know, wish they could just send something that's on their screen, like a photo or a chart or whatever. Anyway, these are just some of the things that BlackBerry's basically had to think about, like what appeals to both consumers and to business people, and how can we appeal to both of those people with one device, with one OS. And they've got a lot of app makers on board, so a lot of the apps that people are going to really, really want, like Skype, like WhatsApp, like what else have they got? Tons of stuff. Angry Birds, obviously, lots of games. They've really gone to town to try and make sure that their app catalog is really big.
Yeah.
And they're saying they've got 70,000 apps for launch, which is actually quite an impressive number. But whether or not it'll be enough to actually tempt people away from iPhone and Android purely on the strength of, physical keyboard and BBM and things like that kind of remains to be seen. They've launched the Z10 in the UK this week, which means we've got it before Canada, which is where BlackBerry is from originally and based. And they're going to be free on contracts on all the major networks. And the Q10, unfortunately, that's the one with the keyboard, has not got a release date for the UK. And I've heard on the down low from trusted sources that it might be Q2 or even Q3 this year before the Q10. It's a lot of Qs.
Yeah.
Gets to us. So,
okay.
Which could be quite annoying, but I'm pretty confident the person I spoke to knows his stuff.
Right.
Q10 wise.
Sources close to the.
Yes. Anyway, we've got hands-on reviews, news, all that sort of stuff about BlackBerry 10 on the website. If you search for just BlackBerry on wired.co.uk, you'll find a bunch of stuff that I wrote and some of our other reporters as well from the show floor. Liv, let's talk about biosensor data. Why has that been in the news this week?
It's been in the news because an artist called Alexis Kirk has written a film that responds to the biosensor data from the audience.
Remind me, what is biosensor data? How do you classify it?
So biosensor data is any kind of, biological data from, in this case, from the human body. So in this particular project, he's looking at EEG data, as in like brainwave activity, heart rate, perspiration levels, and muscle tension.
Okay, so stress, signs of stress.
So signs of stress, exactly. And so what's going to happen, there's this film, a 15-minute film that he's written and directed, and it has multiple potential endings and multiple potential points in the narrative that can be changed based on the data being collected from the audience wearing these sensors. So he's got four different members of the audience for the first showing, going to be wearing these different sensors. And depending on how stressed or how calm they are, it's going to change the outcome of the film.
I think that's so cool.
So what's interesting is that the kind of subject matter of the film, it's called Many Worlds, and it's about two students who go to their friend's house for her 19th birthday and find just a sealed coffin-sized box in her bedroom, but no sign of her. And it seems like their friend, I don't know how they find this out, but her friend has sealed herself into a box with a cyanide gas capsule connected to a Geiger counter, as you do. And at any point, a burst of cosmic rays in the atmosphere could trigger the cyanide and kill Connie. But in fact, she could also already be dead.
It's like Schrodinger's cat. Yeah.
Exactly. That's
I assume they have some kind of sinister handwritten note from some mysterious source. I like how it's all set up.
Yeah, the script is exactly based on the Schrodinger's quantum suicide thought experiment and explores how the kind of observer affects the observed. And that's hence why the observer of the film affects the outcome of the observed, which in this case is the film.
This is interesting. Sorry, I interrupted you. I could see your mouth was about to say more words.
No, that interrupt right. away.
Okay. Now, it reminds me, I think about in sort of early 90s, there was this program, I think, on ITV in the UK, where the audience could decide the next scene of a television program by calling in, and the choice that got the most votes, then the next scene was shown. I remember it was something legal where you had to choose, like, you know, do you believe this person's alibi was accurate or not? And, it would sway the story. That was a very manual way of doing a choose your own plot. This is actually very automated.
Yeah, and I think the idea is sustaining a level of excitement in the audience at all times and kind of, you know, shifting their emotions in kind of ways that they don't necessarily expect. So it's really interesting. It's obviously a very small experiment in this space, but Kirk, the artist, is kind of convinced that this is the way forward for cinema.
Would you watch a film, Leah, where they were judging your body based on... Well,
I'd always watch a film that was judging my body. Yes. No, I think definitely it's a really interesting experiment, but I think that's what it would always be. I think there'd be a market for it, but there's no way the future of filmmaking is all this, because you would never... Can you imagine writers being eternally frustrated that their narrative arc is just shattered by a really sweaty audience?
Like, I like that idea.
Well, up in the office, our whole narrative's being shattered. It's so sweaty at the moment.
Yeah. I could see this actually being used in sort of preview screenings when someone's trying to decide whether an edit should be considered final.
Yeah, in test groups and everything. They do it all the time with adverts now, don't they? It's a kind of marketing thing. But for an actual kind of creative process, it would have to be used differently, I think.
When are people going to be able to see this?
Its debut is on the 23rd of February, and it's part of the Peninsula Arts Contemporary Music Festival in Plymouth. But Kirk wants to then later tour it to other cinemas, and he's got a lot of interest in New York at the moment.
Ah, excellent. Well, if you're in Plymouth, go and then tell us on podcast@wider.co.uk what your experience was like. Liat, let's talk about Bottling Stink.
Yes. Well, not stink. Nostalgia we're talking about here. History. Mm. Nice. Well, some of them stink, actually.
Nasal knowledge.
There are stinky landmarks.
Nasal knowledge.
Well, a designer from Goldsmiths, Olivia Clements, had the idea in her final year to begin bottling kind of inanimate objects, history, landmarks. It all stemmed from a story she read about a woman who kept her father's jumper because of the scent and the memory and the kind of tangible... evocation.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. It's like you smell a jacket, it takes you back. It's like it's very evocative.
Or when you walk past someone on the street who has the same like aftershave or perfume as an ex.
I actually stop walking and, you know, it kind of stops you in your tracks and you're like, come on, don't I know that person?
Yeah.
She happened to me today. But she was kind of compelled by this idea. The woman started thinking that this was something loaned to her from her dead father and kind of all these different issues of what is the essential memory of a person, whether you can distill it down to the colour, scent and DNA and preserve this person. But she started to experiment with whether you can transfer that kind of idea to a time or a place, and built her own distilling kit to try and capture these scents. Now, she's experimented with all kinds of buildings, South Bank Centre, Birmingham NEC, a historical London Victorian pub, and it's basically this quite a basic process of sticking whatever you've got in the distillery kit, boiling the water, capturing the steam, letting it condense.
So what
you can't boil the South Bank Centre.
No.
So what does the South Bank Centre smell
off? A bit of concrete. Well, apparently oil and metal from the JCB lift out the back, if you've ever seen it. Heavy carpet, stale air, ink and blotting paper. Very, very beautiful combination of scents. And I think Birmingham NEC was defined by Subway sandwiches and sweat.
Interesting. So you could put urine in a jar and I would say, that would be the underpass I went through in East London.
Exactly.
Tramp.
Yeah. Actually, near the South Bank. Yeah, exactly. So I think it is an interesting experiment, but the bit that I found most interesting was the pub they did, because it was kind of reimagining the sense of this Victorian era pub, and it was kind of the soapy laundry in the hallways and the prostitutes' perfume and the kind of smoky gentleman's club area.
And this is your favourite, is it? It says a lot about you.
Not, not the syphilis or the kind of rotting stench.
There's a bit of stench in there.
The lack of sanitation.
She doesn't stray from bad smells. That's also why I like this lady. She puts the good and the bad in.
I just said there was a homunculus under the floorboards. What does that even mean?
A tiny little man. It's what they used to think controlled human beings. It's a little man inside your head who was acting as the kind of, well, like the brain that controlled your body.
Yeah, like in Men in Black. Well,
it was a Descartes term.
Sorry, completely.
Yeah, he's been boiled in her kit. Yep, definitely. But I thought that was interesting because she was talking about how obviously scent is so linked with memory that maybe it could have other applications with learning about history, say, down the line.
But she also wants to sell out a little bit and use it for shops to kind of convince people to buy stuff. I mean, that's already used to a certain degree, isn't it?
I mean, sell out's a harsh term, but
commercialize art.
Yeah, I think she likes to see it as design through scent, experiencing design, and, you know, walking past an amazing shop installation like the ones in Selfridges or Harrods and having another level
smell
of experience.
Smell Christmas, for example.
Yeah, which is already being done, and it's kind of a branding tool now, and yet she wants to focus on that. So I think there are things that could be done, whether or not we're just all going to be walking down the street sprayed by annoying shop assistants, but through a window of a shop rather than inside.
What smell would you bottle? Podcast at wired.co.uk. Tell us your scent. We got one more quick story before we get to our little break here, which is that this week a story broke on advertising age that YouTube was going to start allowing people to charge viewers in order to let them watch videos. Specifically, these would be premium channels from selected partners of YouTube with monthly subscriptions, roughly around equates to about £1 to £3 per month. And reports have suggested that producers behind several popular content channels already have been approached by YouTube and have been asked to submit applications to set up channels that they can then charge for. So it's kind of like pay-per-view, but on YouTube.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, there are rumors. I do know that this is happening, and I think that it's broadly understood that it's going to be happening later this year. But it got me thinking, what type of channel would we be happy to pay for? Because a lot of the time, you know, you watch just a YouTube video, but there are a lot of really good channels on there that people do subscribe to. Liv, what would you pay?
Why, that's what
to
I'm
watch
trying to
on
think.
YouTube?
Obviously, they've got a lot of media owners have their own channels, but you know, they're kind of ones I've probably get already through a Sky or Netflix or similar subscription.
Yeah, I actually cannot think of anything.
There might
be
some US channels perhaps that, you know, you can't get without having a very expensive satellite subscription that you might just want one of. I can't think of one that is currently not available to me, but I don't know, maybe.
I think you'll end up having other free channels popping up.
I can think of some great examples.
Like what?
So one of the things I've been doing while I've been learning Japanese is watch tuition videos on YouTube. Lots of really great English speaking.
They're free already.
They're free. But, you know, if you could actually make money from these videos, up the quality or regularity, be able to put more time into them.
But then why wouldn't you just buy one of the, you know, kits?
Well, maybe I would.
Or why would, if you had two and one was slightly better produced, but you had to pay for it, and one was exactly the same, but it was free, would you pay for it?
You'd never know because
you'd
just try the free one.
This is like the argument with news. It's like, why would I pay to get through a paywall when I can read the same story on another site? I think a lot of it comes down to personality.
Quality, yeah.
And it's down to, you know, do I like this person who is doing it? And, you know, there are, as we've all had in the past, there are teachers and then there are teachers.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could use exactly the same words, but one teacher can bring a story or a history to life in a way that bores the living waste out of another group of students.
Yeah, so it's only going to work for characters that people are very attached to.
Maybe it's just a kind of opportunity for a sexually explicit material to generate money.
I don't know. I can't see YouTube doing porn, frankly. I think it's something.
It does really violent content. I don't understand why.
Well, actually, anyway, this kind of transitions into a story we're going to be talking about after the break. So why don't we transition into a ad break? And when we hack our way out, we're going to find out about what Boyfriend Train is all about.
Wired Magazine, Now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. So our discussion topic for the week is Boyfriend Trainer, which Liv, you wrote a very interesting comment piece about this week. Why don't you tell us briefly what Boyfriend Trainer is?
It's a game that revolves around a woman trying to train her boyfriend to be better, which you might think, oh, what's the harm in that? But she does this in kind of beating him into submission using a series of different bizarre weapons. And the crimes that he's being beaten for are fairly trivial, to say the least. So there are a series of levels where your boyfriend misbehaves for things like looking at other women, drinking from your glass of wine, not being interested in your shopping purchases.
What an ass.
Trying to change the channel or to listen to music in the car too loudly.
I'm sorry, but this girl sounds like an absolute...
Well, an embarrassment, quite frankly. Oh, yeah. And with every misdemeanor, the girl's encouraged to beat him in some way. So either with her bare hands, a taser device, that's for dropping clothes on the floor, I think, a badminton racket, pepper spray, a beach umbrella, and even a dog lead that's used to sort of strangle the man every time he drives a bit too quickly.
So he gets beaten for being clumsy.
I mean,
dropping clothes
being messy in that case. But the game is just insulting on so many levels. It's insulting to men, it's insulting to women, it's insulting to anyone who's ever been a victim of domestic abuse. It's a rubbish game just from a kind of gameplay perspective, and I even go as far as to say it's insulting to the weapons that are used.
it's kind of ridiculous that games like this are allowed to be on the App Store, and games like Endgame Syria, which we wrote about a few weeks ago, was pulled off for being associated with real world events. Yeah. And real world governments.
And the other day we saw the 500 Pixels photography app, which is a very popular photography social network, a little bit like Flickr or Instagram, but with a bit of a focus on sort of quality and what have you. And that was pulled because they were found to be what were deemed to be sexually explicit images on there, but really they were artistic nudes.
Yeah.
You know, which has a very rightful place in photography, but yet the app was pulled and they had to make changes before they could have it back in the App Store. Yet
Is it because they're making domestic violence comical that makes it acceptable?
It's not even, I don't know. It's not particularly explicit in terms of violence. You see, they're cartoon characters, but that doesn't
really... If she sticks him in the sauna and turns up the heat, I was pretty
But
upset.
If you just imagine if that was the roles were reversed, the gender roles were reversed, and this was a girlfriend trainer, you can just imagine the uproar. And I don't even think it would be allowed to be approved. So I'm just surprised that the App Store, which is notoriously precious about nudity, as you mentioned, and sometimes violence or politics, has allowed this to be published, and in the Android marketplace as well.
Yeah. Who actually made it?
It's a company in Mumbai called Games to Win. And to be fair, they've made a number of slightly questionable games, including Naughty Secretary, where if she's a hottie, you ought to be naughty, was the strapline for that one. Wow. Naughty Pool Party and Bieber Baby Drama, which the strapline for which is Baby, 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 No. And I think it's relating to a paternity issue with Justin Bieber.
So nudes, artistic nudes not allowed.
So they're deliberately...
Loads of sexually explicit innuendos. Yes.
Well, I have to say, okay, I don't have a problem with, games that use sex as a big central character. You know, there's some great games that are very, very tongue-in-cheek, and they're totally over the top and ridiculous. And you have to kind of laugh at them because it's kind of almost like... not self-parody, but it's sort of like kind of like South Park in a sense, that it takes a subject and blows it up to such a comical level that it's almost a parody of the actual issue at heart or whatever.
Yeah.
But I do agree that I think when it comes to something as highly sensitive as domestic violence, you're out of the realm of comedy and parody and mocking, and you're more in line with something like, you know, animal cruelty and rape.
Yeah.
Like, people aren't making and enjoying playing games about those sort of themes.
Yeah, but this is not a witty commentary. There's no intelligence behind it.
No, and I think the game seems to get away with it, or at least try to get away with it, because it's a woman beating a man, as if that's kind of any better than the vice versa.
And it's definitely, definitely not a commentary on the fact that domestic violence of a woman being overly harsh to a male is... an issue in the real world, right?
Sorry. What do you mean?
In as much as domestic violence is usually perceived as a violent man against a woman, whereas obviously there are many cases of violent women in the relationship.
No, I mean, this is absolutely not not going down that angle. It's just very... I'll give you an example of one of the lessons that are taught within the game. It says... when men take the wheel, it's best that you have them on a leash. He's no Schumacher, so don't let him speed or turn up the music. And this is the level where you have to garrot him with a dog lead. And once you've done that a sufficient number of times, I think it's about 8 times, you get the response, he won't be doing that again. But I would say the company isn't completely heartless. If you beat your boyfriend 3 times when he isn't behaving badly, you know, for one of these awful crimes, you lose and you get a message that says, don't whack him when he doesn't deserve it. Your boyfriend needs his space. Hmm. So there you go.
You've got to make sure the reinforcement is at the right moment.
Exactly.
You don't want to ruin your beating.
So that's how the basis of a strong relationship is beating into submission and training like a dog, I guess.
Well, it sounds a bit like hardcore S&M.
Yeah, well. You know?
And to be fair, there aren't that many apps about that.
No.
Maybe this is it. And this is the sly way in.
Yeah, 50 Shades
of
Fail.
There's no safety word, I don't think, though.
No, I think it's uninstall. Well, let us know what you think. Have we just spent the last 7 minutes annoying you by being wrong? Let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk, or email in with the words, you're completely correct. Well done on being completely correct. We're back on our news horse, galloping through the rest of the show. Now, we have only one more story I wanted to get to, but it's a really important one, I think. It's something that, Leah, you have spent a lot of time researching and putting together for the website this week. Promises of Neanderthal babies damage public trust in science. Quite a statement.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a bold statement.
It is quite a bold statement, but it follows some news from last week, I think.
It is, yeah, it's a bold statement, but we're trying to make the point that last week was just... ridiculous.
Well, hang on. What happened last week?
Well, last week, I hope you all noticed the ridiculous headlines basically telling us to expect the birth of a Neanderthal imminently because we can definitely clone them. We're going to do it tomorrow. And I think most of the headlines led with, all we need is an adventurous woman. And it was a quote taken from a Harvard professor, out of context, from a conversation he had with Der Spiegel, which was hypothetically saying we will have some point in the future the ability to do this.
And you were like, hang on, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And did some investigation.
Yes, I did. I spoke to a fair few interesting genetics experts who were kind of horrified and bemused by the absolute ridiculousness of the whole story and the way it was published in the press. First off, Church said, well, okay, we're going to talk about whether or not we can do it. We can't do it. We can't do it now. If we started doing it now, it could probably take us decades and maybe we'd come close and it would be a disaster. Church said we can do it because we have sequenced the Neanderthal genome, and developmental genetics expert Robin Lovell Badge, who I spoke to, pointed out that there are in fact gaps in the genome, and if we're going to engineer a synthetic version of the Neanderthal genome, there is a high possibility that we're going to make mistakes when we're building it. And he says the gaps are likely to occur around highly repetitive sequences, and these usually have vital functions like cell division. So you're going to end up with
mutations.
Yeah, okay. Serious problems in developmental stages. There was a study done where producing chimeric mice, which is basically introducing human cells into mice and then gradually through their offspring, morphing into, well, this was introducing human chromosome 21 into mice.
And this is separate to growing ears on the back of mice, right?
Yes.
Because when I hear human cells in mice, I just think of the famous ear mouse.
Well, you can still picture him running around with an ear, but he's also got human chromosome 21 in him. But the point was this, was that it took 5 years to do, and they were just introducing a new chromosome. They weren't replacing it, which is what we'd have to do to clone a Neanderthal. We'd be replacing all the information. Now, if we did start doing this with human cells, which would be to kind of take the human genome and start introducing and replacing information with synthesized information from Neanderthals, rejection is possible, and it's just going to take forever because we don't have the means, we don't have any kind of automated means of doing this rapidly enough that it would be of any purpose or point.
So it's a problem here that this story has been blown out of all proportion. People have freaked out about it, like, and you know, lots of people have reacted very strongly from an ethical viewpoint, and that in itself has like caused a lot of damage potentially to the science, the actual positive science that could be done, the good science, if for want of a better word, that could be done in this space that isn't about producing Neanderthal babies immediately. It's about potentially finding cures for some diseases that humans
currently
have.
I mean, Church came out with kind of broad statements about this could help us cure cancer and HIV and all the rest of it. There's a lot of studies going on now which is looking at how gene replacement or animal gene human crossovers would help us learn more about neurodegenerative disorders, and there's things like therapeutic cloning where we are, you know, generating skin cells or tissue for experimentation to develop cure somewhere down the line. And all these kinds of things, you hear the word cloning or another
Neanderthal baby, cave then, baby, I think
yeah, and you're going to associate it every time you hear another story. You will associate it with all the slippery slope, you know, the kind of lazy arguments. And I think the problem is that the press focuses so much on the ethical arguments and the ethical outrage that we don't, if we don't have the science to fall back on when these stories come out, we don't know, actually, no, this isn't possible, this is.
But this,
this
is the,
isn't
but,
cloning, this is just, you
but
know,
that's the thing.
Generating cells.
A lot of the publication that run those things, they just they want the headline, they want to sell their tabloid that day. And to be honest, without sounding too high and mighty, sometimes it is to do with other publications doing follow-ups like this. And, you know, I think we did a great job with this. Many other publications, obviously, on a daily basis are doing very similar work to kind of say, no, radishes are not a cure for cancer, and no, you're not going to be able to use a dog in, I don't know where I'm going with this, but you know what I'm saying.
I mean, the fact that the press sensationalises news isn't really new, and it happens across every sector, but I guess with science it can be potentially damaging for research, because once there's a big public reaction to something, it can undermine applications for funding, etc., in important areas.
Yeah, of course. And if you think even, you know, Church, I don't think was pleased about it at all.
No.
And it could potentially, you know, damage someone's reputation and then damage their chances of getting funding for really important research they're doing down the line. I mean, the whole thing about an adventurous woman was just ridiculous. It was taken completely out of context as something that might happen in, you know, decades and decades time. And if you read the actual quotes from Church, he was saying, we need an ethical debate, we need to really, you know, step back and do this, that and the other. And if you don't see that, you just see the headline, you're not going to read on, you're not going to find out. And it happens all the time.
Well, it's really good, I think, that you looked into this, because I didn't really know that much about the science behind this before I read this. And for anyone who's interested in reading Liat's full feature, search Neanderthal babies on wired.co.uk. It's a long read, it's a good read. Save it for offline viewing, if you will, and print it out and read it over a coffee. We are going to wrap up the show, I think, on that point, though. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch with their feedback.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. We also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And as ever, you can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
You sure can. And Twitter's down at the moment, actually.
I know. Fail whale. Haven't seen that for a while.
Several hours of no Twitter. Where is my life? We're going to go and find out if it's back up, though, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.